This is the fourth day of this April 2009 seven-day session. We'll resume reading from a book called The Way of Korean Zen by Kusan Sunim. Picking up where we left off yesterday, this chapter is called Discourses from a Winter Retreat. This is a three-month retreat. You must possess truthfulness and sincerity in order to practice correctly. Truthfulness and sincerity. Truthfulness makes me think of a dialogue where a monk asked Joshu, what is the first principle of the one wearing Buddhist robes? And he said, not to deceive himself. There are so many ways that we find to deceive ourselves, little games, deceptions that this wily self weaves in the mind to protect itself, defend itself, aggrandize itself. Very humbling in Sesshin to pierce through some of these veils and to see what the mind is up to. This is the first step toward throwing that tyrant out of office. And sincerity. When we're our mind is on the practice, the breath of the koan. To do so sincerely means to really have one's attention there. Not to be doing it mechanically or out of habit or with the mind, part of the mind somewhere else. But sincerely means with the whole mind or the whole heart. Wholeheartedly is what sincerely means. He goes on, to practice simply because others are doing so is just imitation. You will never achieve anything in that way. You must truly awaken in order to be freed from the suffering of birth and death. Knowledge and conceptualization are not appropriate. This phrase, birth and death, the texts are filled with that phrase. We get so used to hearing it. I think it's all too easy to devalue what that really means. Birth and death. It means this cycle of suffering. To consider that the sufferings that we go through periodically, losing people close to us, suffering losses of all kinds, crises, pain, failures, that this will go on and on and on and on until we overturn the whole catastrophe. Which, according to Buddhist doctrine, means supreme perfect enlightenment. But in the meantime, as we go through the losses of life and then the grief of death, this practice enables us to pass through these things more gracefully, more smoothly, with less suffering. In Zen, we can distinguish between pain and suffering. Pain is unavoidable. Pain is unavoidable. To have a body, which again means body-mind, is to experience pain more or less often, or to a greater or lesser degree. But that's the nature of it. Bodhidharma said, anyone who has a body is a heir to suffering, a stranger to peace and an heir to suffering. So we have to make peace with pain. And Zazen is a great way to learn how to deal with pain, which basically comes down to becoming one with it, not fighting it, not thinking about it, not resisting it in our thoughts, not forever strategizing about how to avoid pain. But the ultimate resolution to pain is simply becoming one with the experience itself. So that's pain. Suffering, according to one way of looking at it, suffering is the extra suffering we put on top of the pain by wrapping it around the I and the my, by making a story out of the pain, referring it back to the self, and doing all those things that separate us from the pain. It's thoughts that separate us from the pain. And this is what gives rise to suffering, or what in Buddhism is sometimes called pain on top of pain. It's that second, that compounded pain or suffering, dukkha, that we can find our way out of through practice. When you investigate the koan and intend to awaken to your great original nature, you must be like a hen hatching eggs. Think about how much effort the hen must exert in order to successfully hatch eggs. From dawn to dusk, she constantly pecks and searches for food. Imagine how hungry she gets while sitting on the eggs all day long. If she frequently leaves to eat or drink, only half of them will hatch properly. The rest will rot. While the hen is hatching her eggs, she does not just sit quietly. She moves the eggs around with her feet in order to evenly distribute the heat. Only in this way will the chicks hatch successfully. How does she know how to do that? It is the same for somebody practicing meditation. Whether you are investigating what is this or mu, the practice will not mature if you just hold the koan motionless. If you just watch it, repeating, what is this, what is this, then you would be like a hen trying to hatch her eggs without moving them. This would be foolish. You cannot awaken in this manner. You must be like the hen who moves her eggs around. Now, I think we can apply this even if you're not working on a koan, or if maybe you are working on a koan, even when you're not questioning the koan, the spirit of this analogy is to be sure that you're actively engaged with the practice. Because one doesn't have to be. One can be sort of staring deadly at the practice, the breath or the koan, and not really be actively engaged. Anyone who has made this shift, and not that it's a permanent thing, one can go in and out of this, but anyone who has made this shift knows what I'm talking about, that there's a way in which there can be kind of a static, passive, again, kind of staring at the breath or the koan, but then to straighten one's back and look sincerely, look into it, whether it's a koan or not, look into it and get involved really in a vital way, then even the stillness is a vibrant stillness. There's something going on there. You're cooking. And again, one of the signals that you're not doing that, one of the signals that it's kind of dead, is when you're getting bored. If you're bored, then you just gotta step it up. Turn up the heat, which just means get more concentrated, more thoroughly concentrated in the practice. It should be a sense of a dynamic working, even though it's just the breath and not a koan. You must also be like a cat trying to catch a mouse. Observe the look of a cat that is trying to catch a mouse at the foot of a stone wall. While slinking along at the base of the wall, it keeps its eyes firmly fixed on the hole where the mouse entered. At a place far away from the hole, it then sits silently in hiding. Its eyes continue to stare piercingly at the hole while waiting for the mouse to come out. This is what I was just talking about, this dynamic, active engagement, even though the cat is just sitting perfectly still. At such a time, even if a person, a chicken or a dog, goes near the cat, it takes no notice of their passing and continues to watch the mouse hole. If the mouse appears for even an instant, like a flash of lightning, it leaps and grabs it. If even a cat proceed so mindfully when trying to catch a mouse, how much more so should a person pursue awakening when practicing meditation? Well, don't, yeah, it could be misleading. It's not that that our task as we're sitting is to pursue awakening, the thought of awakening. It's to become absolutely one with the practice. Roshi Kapler used to use the example of a dog, where you holding up a bone in front of a dog. I can still hear him saying, that dog's whole world is the shape and size of that bone. That's the dog's samadhi. Furthermore, you must practice with a feeling of urgency as though you were trying to extinguish a fire burning on your head. This is a classical metaphor for this practicing with great energy and urgency. In such a situation, would you stop to ponder, is this heat due to fire? Or is it really burning or not? Is there anybody present here who would experiment and let the fire burn for a while to see how well it burns? Under such circumstances, without thinking, you would immediately brush your hand over your head in order to get rid of the fire. You should cultivate meditation with the same sense of urgency. To live long would be to live for 100 years. A short life is over in the time it takes to inhale and exhale a single breath. 100 years of life depends upon a single breath, for life stops when respiration ceases. Can you afford to wait for 100 years when you do not know how soon death will come? You may die after having eaten a good breakfast in the morning. You may die in the afternoon after a good lunch. Some die during sleep. You may die in the midst of going here and there. No one can determine the time of death. Therefore, you must awaken before you die. A defiled person will call this world a sea of suffering. An awakened one will call it a Buddha world. At that time, the 10,000 things will be transformed into the 10,000 subtle functions. For an enlightened person, it is simply all illuminated. For a defiled person, it is simply all defiled. All is arising from your own mind. The Buddha world arises from your own mind. Its transformation into the sea of suffering likewise arises from your own mind. Assembly, reflect on this. I trust that your practice will progress during this winter retreat. So now we're on to the second, what's called the second lecture. Or second teshom, we would say. Since we have entered this meditation retreat, 2 weeks have gone by. Now only 75 days remain. The sufferings of transmigrating within the ocean of birth and death, as well as the happiness of the sublime Dharma Dhatu appearing brilliantly clear before your eyes, do not come from outside. They are also not given to us by anyone else. You do not have to endure sufferings because someone else gave them to you. Neither does someone else grant you happiness. They are created and experienced by yourself alone. You have to endure sufferings because you created them yourself. Likewise, you experience happiness because you have created it yourself. And of course, we create either of these by how we use or misuse the mind. It's just stunning when you think about it. It's such an obvious thing that our happiness or lack of happiness is determined by the mind. Everyone's. why doesn't everyone, or at least every intelligent, reasonably intelligent person, want to do meditation? That's how we change our experience of life. By laying down new pathways, new circuits for how we process change, how we deal with circumstances, how we react to change or not react, the way we respond to things. All of it determines our experience of life, and is itself is determined by the way we use the mind. We have some choice in how we use our attention. That's what it all comes down to. What we choose to direct our attention to. You should take great awakening as your aim and model, and never let the mind be at ease. If you act without caring to raise the koan, mind and body will surely be at ease. But this is just like water flowing away. Indeed, the lives of sentient beings flow away like this. So he's making the point that say if you're working on a koan and if you get deeply enough into the koan that it delivers you to a place of great peace and rest, and if you just abandon the koan because you're digging on the peace and rest and clarity and spaciousness and stillness, then, of course, this is a wonderful state to be in. But it is a conditioned state. It will pass. One has to break through the koan in order to stand a chance of really assimilating this marvelous silence and spaciousness. Conversely, we all know, anyone who's worked on a koan, that it's basically a pain in the ass to work on a koan. It's just it's like a thorn in your side. It just, and so obviously it's for those who want something more than comfort and ease, or something more than ordinary, conditional comfort and ease. It's those who want to transcend the whole dichotomy of pain and joy, getting beyond it all. In a way, you could say that getting into this state of wonderful, peaceful stillness is reaping good karma. It's the effect. Finding that kind of peace in your zazen is the effect of a lot of hard work and upright practice. But karma is not permanent. I mean, it's not. It comes and it goes. We evolve and devolve. But for most of us, we have to go through this, and usually more than once, where we just get into this state and then say, "Oh yeah, who needs you, koan?" And then just enjoy it until then we come crashing down and have to, then we go back begging to the koan. Fair weather friend. Now, having taken up the practice of 10,000 actions, I don't know what that means exactly, just I guess the real Zen practice is something that you do continuously in everything you do. Having taken up the practice of 10,000 actions, you should endure what is difficult to endure and do what is difficult to do. This is known as austerity, for the very reason that it involves undergoing what is difficult. The Buddhas and the ancestors did not realize Buddhahood easily. They realized it through great effort and much hardship. They exerted themselves with such great effort because the sufferings of birth and death are so terrifying. Therefore, even though you want to sleep more, you should sleep less. Even though you want to eat more, you should eat less. Even though you want to talk a lot, you should try to talk less. Even though you want to see many things, you should see less. Your body will definitely feel restrained by acting in such a way. This is indeed a practice of austerity. However, none of the Buddhas and the ancestors would have awakened had they not trained themselves in this manner. The talking here, even though you want to talk a lot, you should try to talk less. In these three-month retreats, they don't have the strict rule of no talking. Even though you want to see many things, you should see less. Even though you want to surf the web all the time, you should see less. And then he ends the chapter. Last autumn, the maple trees were a brilliant red, the chrysanthemums fragrant, the mountains and rivers a magnificent sight. When we see all these beautiful things, we all know how to be happy. During endless eons, in every life, we have been praising such things. It is not only this one time that we have praised them. When the moon is bright and the wind blows, some say that the moon is shining brightly and a refreshing wind is blowing. However, others say that the moon looks bleak and the wind is dreary. In reality, do you think that the moon is shining brightly to some and bleakly to others? This is not the case. These are circumstantial impressions arising from their own minds. Third lecture. Since the subtle wisdom of complete enlightenment has been present even before the creation of the earth, it has never been lost. Why do you say that you are looking for it again? From long ago until now, it has been unimpeded and has been shining brightly and tranquilly. Assembly gathered here today, have you completely awakened to it or not? If there is a monk endowed with the Dharma eye, let him say something. In reality, what is this subtle wisdom of complete enlightenment? Huck! Let me introduce you to a few words from a talk of Master Zongjing. He once said, "All sentient beings are covered by the six dusts." This means that they are covered by the six kinds of thieves that come from the outside. The six dusts, of course, refer to the six senses, but an impure functioning of the senses. That is, instead of just clean, direct perception of hearing, seeing, smelling, tasting, touching, or thinking, instead of just the thing itself, there is this residue that follows the experience of, let's say, the sound of the train. The residue is thoughts, which come from clinging. And this becomes the dust of the thoughts. The thieves, there's a quite extensive passage later in the book about these thieves. He says, if you feel that you are not yet a Buddha, this means that the downfall of the six thieves is still to take place. All things in the external world that pass through the six sense doors are like thieves who are intent on cheating you. They continuously deceive you and drag you here and there. And as soon as you are deceived in even the slightest way by one of these thieves, it is equivalent to being killed by them. For at that moment, they take control of your mind. Because of them, intrinsic Buddhas, just means intrinsically enlightened ones, means all of us, are made to act like ordinary sentient beings, unenlightened ones. In the face of these six thieves, you need the courage of a soldier on the front line fighting the enemy. When suddenly faced with an enemy in the midst of a battle, a soldier does not have the time to ponder whether his adversary can shoot well or not, or whether such a shot would be fatal. In order not to risk being killed by the enemy's fire, he is simply forced to shoot immediately. Similarly, as soon as the slightest thought appears in the doorway of one of the six senses, you should be as alarmed as though a thief were trying to break into your house. The moment one of the six thieves shows itself in the doorway of the senses, the koan investigation of the essential will have deserted you. Otherwise, how could one of the thieves have appeared in the first place? For as long as the koan is held firmly in mind, the six sense doors will be kept tightly closed, and there will be no gap through which a thief could enter. Therefore, while the koan remains vivid, you remain alive. But as soon as one of the six thieves manages to enter the door of the senses, you are already dead. Well, to our ears, he may be overstating it a bit, but consider how easily the mind is distracted by a sight, a sound, a feeling, a smell, a taste, a thought. Now, we certainly don't want to go to the point where we stop up our ears, anesthetize the skin, put blindfolds on, and all these other things, or do a lobotomy so we can't think. But it sure helps to keep the eyes down. Something about this sense of sight that really can get thoughts going. We look around, there's a perception, a thought just naturally follows from that very easily, and from that thought another and another and another, and before long we're far astray. can't go through our lives like that, but for a week, it really can help to keep the eyes down, to refrain from talking, engaging in words any more than we have to. He goes on, in order to cause the downfall of the six thieves, you must cast aside all concern for the body. You should discard it as you would a useless stone that serves no purpose. Habitually, you blindly follow your uncontrolled attachment to the body and thus spend your entire lives trying to feed it and clothe it well, thereby making sure that it is comfortable. Throughout beginningless eons, you have been the servant of the body and have thus played the role of an ordinary sentient being. But from now on, you should learn to make it serve you. Likewise, instead of being captivated by the six senses, you should also make them obey you. Henceforth, it is you who must have the final word. In this way, your practice will be able to progress well. It is a great mistake to think that after having practiced hard for a few days, you are then entitled to lie back and enjoy yourself for a while. It is easy to find any number of pretexts for behaving in this manner, but to do so will cause you to be killed by the six thieves. Thus, you will be reduced to playing the role of a corpse. This stuff is no fun to hear, because we know most of us that we capitulate to our bodily appetites, our cravings, too much to really become the master of them. It is the most natural thing in the world to want to sleep more, eat more, rest more. But where has that got us? We've been doing this, he reminds us, we've been doing this for lifetimes and lifetimes, just taking the path of least resistance, following the easy way, the comfortable way. It's not a matter of that there's some virtue in the denial itself, as if this shows some superior character. Oh, there's something to that, but that's not the point. The point is that as long as we yield to our cravings, our sense cravings, then we will miss what is beyond the senses. That's the point. And then once we have experienced, when we have awakened to our true nature and seen what is beyond the senses, then we can again enjoy the senses in a different way. Assembly of monks, it is true that these days you are exerting much effort in your practice of meditation. However, I would like to add a few words for your benefit. Of the 90 days of this winter retreat, already half have passed, for today we have reached the midpoint of the meditation season, and only 45 days are now left. Every day, time flows on urgently like water. Even though it may seem that there are certain enjoyments in daily life, actually we are just like fish in a pool whose water is constantly being drained away. I love that analogy. We're like fish in a pool whose water is constantly being drained away. When all the water has gone, the fish will surely die, won't they? Likewise, not only you monks gathered here, but all sentient beings are traveling the path that only leads to death. As each day passes, your lifespan decreases by one day, and as each hour passes, it decreases by one hour. Just listen to this clock. With every tick, the second hand moves. With every tick, the second hand moves, pauses, and moves on again. This itself can immediately be taken as a Dharma lecture of the Buddha. Therefore, the demon of transiency is propelling us toward death every moment. If you do not realize the truth of the unborn, then when the time of death suddenly arrives, you will find yourself moaning in illness. Even though nobody wants to die, every one of us will inevitably perish. Is there anyone here among you whose body is not a potential corpse? If there is, then speak out. Furthermore, should we live solely for the benefit of this potential corpse? Or would it be better to live in order to awaken to the truth of the unborn? When you are finally moaning in illness, then you may have regrets at not having diligently practiced while alive. But at that time, such regrets will be in vain. Therefore, why do you not practice now? Why do you just continue to play around? Our time is up. We'll stop and recite the four vows.